know, I don't know, because they're just starting now to do more prospective studies. You know, in terms of retrospective studies, you ask somebody who's depressed or has a psychiatric illness, what they remember, well, for all of us, even without any illness, we remember things in colored ways. So I don't know enough about what prospective studies have been done. I know about retrospective studies, but I think that they're biased. But we do know that there's something that happens in the brain. That we do know. And I'll just quickly show this to you. This was a study was done where people with BPD were asked to look at faces, and the faces were either neutral, showed anger, et cetera. Are you all familiar with this? Yeah. Okay, this is Ekman, so I won't go much into it. But what... Well, so people were asked to look at different faces and to, was that a happy face, a sad face, or whatever. And people with BPD showed significantly greater left amygdala activation. So they were put into a scanning machine or a PET scan or MRI or something like that while they were, I guess, looking at the faces. And they could see that their brains, the amygdala in their brains were different than people who didn't have BPD. What was interesting was that BPD patients attribute negative qualities to neutral faces, and I think this is very important, because when you work with someone with BPD and they're reading something or they think first of all, I love this, borderline patients say they read you so well. They always say that, I'm very well at reading you. Thinking, okay, maybe they are, maybe they're not. But the bottom line is that they also look at things from a different perception and tend to go more towards negativity. And here's just a picture of the brain. So the course and the outcome of the disorder, and this is a slide from Dr. John Gunderson. I had never seen this before, and so I'm assuming it's probably not something that's been out that much. But this is sort of the age of onset of the disorder. Adolescence, 13 to 17, 15%. Okay. Now, no one looked at younger ages, but we know that we can see these personality traits in younger children, too. We just don't know if it's going to develop into a psychiatric disorder. Early adulthood, ages 18 to 25, about 50%. Young adulthood, 26 to 30, 25%. And adulthood, 31 to 48, is 10%. I think also, and John Gunderson had said this, that he was seeing some middle-aged women coming in for the first time with the disorder. And often when you track it, you can either see that their marriage is broken up or maybe that they're going through menopause or something else has been introduced that has changed the environment for them. Just a pitch that we need to diagnose people under 18 with the disorder. It's the only way that they're gonna get the help that they need, and that adult patients recognize that they had this since adolescence. And we know that personality evolves in childhood. And we also know as parents that each child has their own unique personalities. In inpatient units, 49% of an adolescent unit are with BPD adolescents. So that's almost half of the psychiatric wards for adolescents are with BPD patients. I'm sorry. Right. No, absolutely. And because of their perception, yeah. Well, there's a new book out called Blue Night by Joan Didion. I don't know if anyone's read it. And she says that her daughter, who then killed herself, had borderline personality disorder. And there's a line in there where she says, why are borderline patients so misunderstood, and why are we misunderstood as their parents? And I think that's very true. I have a study, but I won't go into it, where we test perceptions. Well, I don't know enough about... Well, one thing I've heard is that oftentimes psychiatric disorders emerge during adolescence because of hormonal changes and things. So just from a general picture, I'd say that. And the variability, I would probably say, is what happens in the environment. What is their environment like? Not that the environment per se causes it, but when you think there's this genetic piece and then something happens in the environment. All right, so I won't, you can read more of this online, but what we also know is that these adolescents lack skills, and that's where DBT is so crucial, is that we need to be teaching them skills. They're not acting out or using that pejorative term. What the problem is, they don't have skills to manage things. They also say they're not to use medications for adolescents. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, there's some borderline patients who, I've had some borderline patients that I've never been raged at. You know, the anger is just not there in the way that it is in some others. And then I actually worked with a woman many years ago. She said, I never get angry. I said, you never get angry? No. We were on an inpatient unit then. And then the next day I heard she had taken a light bulb, broken it, and cut her wrist. She was in such a rage. She didn't even know she was angry. So the anger can look different in different patients. It doesn't have to. It's not that all of them can get so angry. Okay. This is just a study. This is the McLean study for people getting better. And Mary Zanarini's been following patients now, I think it's for 18 years. And you can see the percentage that remit every 2 years as she's doing her study. And up to now, it's 80% after 10 years. And what's also so very nice about this disorder is that people don't relapse. 12% relapse back. But if you think of major depression, that once you've had a major depression, you're more likely to have another one, that it's something that can come back. Bipolar disorder, same kind of thing, but not with BPD. What does recover soonest is the most improved is impulsivity. The impulsivity goes down. Also, it goes down with age. When you hit about 40, you're a little less impulsive. But as somebody said, you have to hope they live to be 40 with their self-destructiveness. The cognitive interpersonal is the next, and the least improved is the mood instability. So somebody with BPD may be holding down a job, doing great, but their moods still may be up and down. Might not be to the extent where it's interfering with their lives. These lines just show studies that how drastically things can change. They were just looking at it from different beginning and end points. So what's the treatment? Well, these are the different treatments that are out there now. There are six that have been proven to work. Dialectical behavior therapy, I think, has 21 studies now. Many of them now not done by Marshall Linehan, which is the goal in research. You don't want the developer of the treatment to be the researcher. The second one that's had the most research is mentalization-based treatment. That has two. So you think of 21 versus two. DBT is really much more researched. DBT is a cognitive behavioral approach. It's based on the idea that people with a disorder have skills deficits, so that there's skills that they learn. And just to put the spectrum of these different treatments, there's cognitive behavioral therapy, which is DBT, and then a program called STEPS. And if you want to, if you're a patient and you want to get STEPS, you need to either move to Iowa or to Holland. That's all where you can find it. Okay? STEPS, it's a manualized program, and I can do it backwards. Right. Systems training for emotional predictability and problem solving. Yeah. Then there's schema-focused therapy. That's something that's relatively new with, I forgot his first name, Young's. Jeff Young, thank you. Right, and I don't know if you can find that outside New York. I don't know where else it's being done, but that's also out there. And then there's the mentalization-based treatment that you can find up at McLean Hospital, UCLA, and it's getting more and more popular. Actually, anybody who's interested in getting trained, although it's over Shabbos, is that McLean Hospital is doing a two-day training in January. And then there's transference-focused therapy, which is Dr. Otto Kernberg's treatment. That I think you can find in New York, maybe in Westchester County, and then go to Europe, because I don't think you're going to find it other places. And then there's something called general psychiatric management. This, though, is something that was tested against DBT. It was shown to be as effective. John Gunderson now is actually going around talking about it. The limiting factor of this is that it's done by psychiatrists. And in my experience, I haven't even seen that many psychiatrists doing other than medication with BPD patients. But okay, so here's dialectical behavior therapy. I've just sort of gone through that. Dialectical behavior therapy has three approaches. It's the dialectics, which is finding a balance between things. That's what dialectics means. In DBT, it's finding the balance between acceptance and change. What do we need to accept, and what do we need to change? It's a wonderful sort of treatment to be doing because you get to go back and forth. How many people in here are DBT trained? Good, because I know a group went. You all were intensively trained. You went and did the 10-day? Yeah, terrific. Okay, so you know what I'm talking about. Validation is key, and I'll review that because that's a big thing for families. Acceptance, and it's based on behavioral principles. There are four modules in DBT. There's mindfulness, which is really about being centered and knowing and understanding what you're thinking and feeling and being able to tolerate the moment. There's distress tolerance, which is sort of crisis survival strategies. They call it when you're at the end of your rope, but I think you use this way before you're at the end of your rope. There's emotion regulation skills and interpersonal effectiveness skills. This is mentalization. The longest study shows the gains have been maintained for 8 years. It's a relatively easier approach to conceptualize in training, but it's hard to really be able to understand it and I think to implement it. And the general psychiatric management is the one that I just told you about that's done by psychiatrists. Okay, so what we want to make sure is that people who are working with these patients are trained. It does require specialized training. It should be needed. The goals should be targeting what that specific patient's issues are, and there should be a primary clinician who's an expert. And impulsive BPD patients should be working with more than just one therapist because it does take a team. When somebody is suicidal, self-injuring, you need to be part of a team. Okay, so that's the disorder. Let's go on to families. Any questions just from what I've presented so far? Right. So somebody's born. Yeah. They don't learn the skills for whatever reason. They haven't learned them. So they're born emotionally vulnerable, and then they have not acquired the skills the way other children do and develop them with coping skills. So it's a skill deficit, but it's based on the emotional vulnerability. Right. 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 And I'm glad you used the word maladaptive because, unfortunately, these coping skills often are effective. The cutting does bring down anxiety, but it's not something you can continue to do. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Individual, right? Yeah, this is the hardest question to answer because you know why? There's no answer. And Marsha Linehan I'm so sorry. The question is basically succinctly is what do you do if the patient doesn't want to go into treatment? So you have everybody else in treatment maybe, but that patient won't go. And we did a conference with Marsha in Seattle, and she was asked that question, and she said, you can't force someone to go into treatment. You just can't. And Friday night I was actually, I don't know those of you who are aware, there's a football player named Brandon Marshall. He plays for the Miami Dolphins. I've never watched a football game in my life, but I'm watching it now, because he came out with the disorder in July, and he now wants to be a public spokesman. And actually, he started a foundation, and there was a kickoff Friday night, so I went down to Florida for his kickoff. And Afshag, I can show you, he did a public service announcement that we're trying to get aired across the country, where he says, I have borderline personality disorder. And I forgot why I brought that up. It was... Right. Thank you. So I was sitting with somebody Friday night at this cocktail party, and she has borderline personality disorder, and she wouldn't go for treatment. And now she's a coach for people with the disorder. She's gotten trained. She was absolutely wonderful. And her husband was sitting there, and I said, well, we have to clone you, because he's really been wonderful with her. But so I said to her, well, what made you go into treatment? I said, what would you give people advice? She said, just leave us alone. She said, we'll get to it. But the more people push, the less likely we are to go. And I, you know, so here were two people, both with the disorder, because Marcia has had the disorder, saying there's nothing you can do, and maybe stop trying to make it happen. Yes, and Marcia says that, absolutely. She will say that, you know, even people when after they are not, they don't have the disorder, they're still emotionally vulnerable. That doesn't change. It's not like their skin gets so hardened, you know. Yeah. Right. No, that's a great question because, you know, you're supposed to have 5 out of those 9, right? You can have 2 and your life's a mess. So oftentimes when people come in, and they will come in that way and say, well, my psychiatrist says I have major depression and borderline features. So then we look at what are the features, and that's then what we're targeting. So you don't have to have just the disorder. If you have some of the traits, your life can be poor as well. Yeah. The children? Yeah. The emotional vulnerability? Yeah. Yeah. Yes, there's, and I'm going to lead up to that. There's, in schizophrenia, there's a man named Dr. Bill McFarland, who really was the leader for psychoeducation for families that are relatives with schizophrenia. And I saw him a few years ago, and he said, we found the cure. He said, the cure is going in early into these families where they're high-risk kids and teaching the families how to respond differently. And same thing with borderline. I mean, when you think about what families are asked to respond to, whether it be a young child, and if we could go in early into the homes and teach families to be more validating. I mean, I'll give you an example of an invalidating statement. You know, your child says, I'm thirsty, and you say, no, you're not. You just had a drink 10 minutes ago. Well, I mean, as adults, who tells us when we're thirsty, right? But these are the kinds of things that for a child with borderline tendencies, it's just invalidating. They don't know what to make of it. So early intervention, going into the homes would be wonderful. You know, not so. It hasn't really been used. It hasn't been shown to help narcissism. There is, though, a woman named Elsa Rodingstam, and she is sort of the big person in narcissism. And she's actually writing a book now, a treatment book, because I don't think there are treatments out there for narcissism. And I wouldn't. I think that what DBT could do is it could make the person more maybe aware of what they're feeling. And then you'll see actually when I talk about the family program, we talk about relationship mindfulness, which is about basic mindfulness is about me and me being centered. Relationship mindfulness is being aware of another person and maybe in some ways some levels of narcissism. But I wouldn't rush to do DBT for narcissism until there's data out there. But I wonder also, maybe narcissism also has comorbidities of other things as well. So it might be useful for those. Yeah. Yeah. I'll repeat the question. If there's a borderline mother with borderline personality disorder, what's the prevalence of her child or the likelihood of her child having the disorder? And I don't know if there's any data on that. I will show you later, though, because I'm so excited about it, and I meant to bring it, but I have slides from it, that someone now has written a book for children whose mother has borderline personality disorder. And it's just a wonderful book that hopefully will be out in a few months with beautifully illustrated that what do children do when their mother has a disorder and how do you help them cope with it? So it's a great question. I don't have an answer, but I'll see if there is anything out there. I doubt it. Well, you know, and I don't have this. Oh, sorry. The question is on a continuum of borderline and narcissism. What did you say that they sort of go in together? Right. The continuum. I don't think I know it well enough to explain it, but if we think of all of these disorders running across a line, there is certainly narcissism. There are parts of narcissism that fit with BPD, and I think during lunch I'm going to pull up. Oh, I hope I have a slide where we, in terms of the different disorders, narcissism. I think maybe 25% of people with BPD are narcissistic as well. Yeah. Say that again. Oh, yeah, it's a good question. In other words, do they not go for treatment because their narcissism keeps them out? I don't think we know. Yes, and then I'll. Well, I don't even think then you have to label the parent. You just say that at times your mom gets upset. So the question was, what do you do if the mother has borderline, doesn't acknowledge it, you're working with the child, how do you help the child? And my response is that you don't have to label it as a diagnosis, but your mom gets upset about this and this. What can you do when she's getting so upset? So that's what I would do. I mean, I'm always very loath to diagnose anybody that I haven't sat in a room with. You know, even families who come and, you know, and it certainly sounds like borderline, but until you meet somebody, it's very hard. You don't want to sort of get into that gray zone. Yes. So what are the traits in childhood that you might see? I think impulsivity. I think poor social judgment. Anxiety, maybe. You saw in this quick video that at 9 she was already suicidal. I don't know, anybody else want to throw in the mix? Hypersensitivity, right. Paranoid? Okay, I don't know if I would think borderline, but... Right, yeah, certainly that, the emotional instability. Distress, intolerance, yeah. Substance abuse, right, yeah. No, so all these things. Well, you're right. We don't, the gentleman said all that could be autism. You're right, we don't know. But what we do know is that when we can see the disorder in adolescence, we can diagnose it. Some people will say, well, it's really adolescence at its worst. But it really steps more over a line than that. I think you really can see what it is. Go on our website. We have 100 audios and videos for free watching. Look up a man named Blaise Aguirre, A-G-U-I-R-R-E. And he runs an adolescent unit at McLean Hospital. He opened up his unit 4 years ago for two beds. And now next week they're going to go to 26 beds and they can't keep up with it. And it's not for free. Let me just say that. I won't even go into price. But the point being is that adolescents are out there. They're more and more getting treatment, and we need to encourage them to get treatment. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. And the question is that there are people out there not getting diagnosed, and we really need to encourage that that happen. And that's what I hope one of the take-home messages will be here today. Also, it's there. What I find is that I work with a psychiatrist that I know is comfortable with BPD. So if he's going to see it, he's going to say it. And you might want to think when you're working with a psychiatrist, have they never diagnosed anyone with BPD? So know who you're working with as a team. Well, it can emerge into that. It's oppositional defiant disorder. What's the separation? And I don't think we really know. I think we have to wait and see. I mean, that also can lead into antisocial. So, you know, there's such gray zones, and this is actually why the DSM-5 is going to be more on a continuum. Rather, it's going to be dimensional rather than categories, because these things all do swoosh into each other. Oh, yes. So AGUIRRE. The easiest way to do it is when you go on our website on the home page, look for the Atlanta conference. That was actually just 4 weeks ago. And the video's up there, and you'll see some of these slides up there, and go through Dr. Blaise Aguirre's talk. What can the schools do? Well, I think first of all, what can the schools do? I think they first need to know what they're dealing with. And actually, one of the things that we're hoping to do, I told you we have this five-part video series, is that, and I'm going to show some of it later because it's so powerful, is that we hope to put together a short video to help schools know what to look for. There's also a teen screen out in the community. It's done out of Columbia University, and they're screening teenagers for all these different diagnoses. They won't screen for BPD. So we need to scream loud, and we need to help educators. Yitzi? No, and I think that's fabulous. I think they're trying to do it somewhat in the public schools, but I think that there's probably more hurdles than there are in the private schools. But the DBT skills are great for everybody. So, you know, that being said, they don't have to have the diagnosis. Yes. You know, the question would be is what you're targeting. So just like in therapy, you have targets. What actually are you targeting with that child or that adult? Look, I don't even think with children they need to know diagnoses. They're really about being able to manage their daily lives better. But that being said, if you don't tell them they have BPD, then what do they think they're targeting? Does that answer your question? No. Go ahead, say more then. Exactly. On what you think of the problems. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it could be, but I don't think so. There's any research out there. That's what I would, that's my simple answer about conduct disorder in DBT. Anybody else? Okay, so let's go on to families now. Here's the profile of families, okay? Yes. Well, but the bipolar disorder is being treated with medication, right? Right. So you it's a win-win because they have the medication and they're learning skills. And there's not any medication that's been proven to work for borderline personality disorder, so all these medications are being used off-label. Not that that's a problem. And some of them are the same that's being used for bipolar disorder because of the mood lability. So this is what families deal with. How many of you work with families who have a relative with the disorder? Yeah, okay. So having someone with a disorder is very, very burdensome on a family, okay? Actually, in our groups, because we work with families with the disorder, we'll oftentimes get somebody who has a relative with schizophrenia and borderline personality disorder, and they say, take the schizophrenia any day. It's the borderline piece that's really killing us and really making our lives unlivable. So a mental illness is a catastrophic event for families in general, and comparable to other natural calamities of combat, imprisonment. We held a training for family members to run our course, and this is what was said in that training. The doctor said, "There's nothing I can do for your daughter." Imagine as a parent being told that. And a father was told, the doctor whispered quietly in my ear, borderline. And for me, sitting in a room with family members with 50 borderline personality disorder relatives is witness to ongoing trauma. These families every day are living with trauma. And I would bet, there's no real research out on that, that our family members have post-traumatic stress disorder. There was one mother who said that she can't bear her cell phone ringing because the sound of it just is so terrifying to her. So what I told her to do, and I know it sounds simplistic, is I told her to change the phone ring, because at least changing that stimulation obviously working on other things as well, but to be able to survive this, you need to come up with creative ways of being able to tolerate the stress that you're under. Those of you who are parents and parents of children who are old enough to do certain things, imagine what it's like your child calling and saying, I have a bottle of pills and I'm about to take them and I'm not going to tell you where I am. I mean, that's what these families live with. Early on, when people were working with relatives with a psychiatric disorder, there was a construct called expressed emotion. And what this was started in the 50s in England, where they assessed a family member and their level of hostility, critical comments, and involvement with the relative. And what it was found was that across the board, when a family member was more critical or more hostile or more emotionally over-involved, the patients did less well over a year. So that began the development of the creation of family psychoeducation programs. The goal was to reduce this level of an expressed emotion. Now you can imagine how families felt about this, because it was saying, you've done something wrong and you need to change the way you act. Now we do say that, but we don't say it's the cause of the illness. What we say is it's a way of modifying something. But anyhow, there was a lot of outrage by families over the years, and in part this is probably what started the impetus for the National Alliance on Mental Illness. So what's happened then is that did reduce relapse rates in the community. It wasn't borderline, those patients weren't included. And over the past 3 years, though, the family well-being began to be a goal. Those family psychoeducation programs were really for the patient's well-being. And then there were some wonderful people like Dr. Harriet Leffley and a group of them that said, what about us? What about family members? And so the programs began to work towards reducing the distress in the families. But nothing was for borderline personality disorder. NAMI designed their wonderful family-to-family program. How many of you are familiar with it? That's really amazing, because if you would go to other mental health professionals in the secular world, 80% of the hands would go up, because this is the nation's voice on mental illness. I'm surprised. Those of you, Yitzi? Great. That's terrific. And that's the same thing with our course is getting, but I have, well, I won't go, well, let me just as an aside, that we, our family course is modeled after family to family, and I'll go into that later. We have a conservative Jewish woman who's trained, and then she has we have another woman trained. They are willing to do it in the Orthodox community. And I put it out on the listserv of Nefesh, were there any people who knew of families who could benefit from a course? I didn't get one response. Now, my sense is that families don't want to be with other families. And I think that's the stigma. Yeah. 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 Well, I've had two Orthodox people in a group that I ran. I both let them know ahead of time that there was someone from their community. I said, you might not know each other. They both said, we're so desperate, we don't care. Yeah. Yeah. The other alternative, and we do this for our courses, we run it by phone because we don't have a group in Idaho or wherever. So we do it what we call teleconnections, and that might serve the community better. You know, nobody, they don't even have to use, they can use their more American name so that it's not even a connection. So it's something to think about. So NAMI's 12-week course is fabulous. They train family members, as Yitzi said. There's no charge for the course. It's an evidence-based program. And in each class, there are at least two families who have a BPD relative, and I would venture to say they're more than that. So even NAMI, and we just held a meeting down in Washington about 2 weeks ago with the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NIMH, SAMHSA, which is our services branch of our government, saying that we need to do something for families with this disorder. So we're hoping to get things more out there. But I do encourage you to go to NAMI's because it's wonderful. This is what Joyce Berlin says, who is the designer of the family-to-family program we're talking about. There is perhaps no serious mental illness more maligned and misconstrued than borderline personality disorder. So everybody's recognizing that our group of families needs something different. There were some hands up. I didn't. Yes, sorry. Well, first of all, the program that we do is not for the ill relative. It's for the family member. It's putting your own oxygen mask on first because then you can better help yourself and maybe your loved one. There was a study that was done in Sweden. We never tested the patients. We only tested family members and what worked for them. But there was a study that took our program, did it in Sweden, for suicide attempters, which is our population, and found they tested the patients too. The patients got better. So, you know, we're doing some tweaks in the environment that people then respond to. Yeah. Unfortunately, we don't have room to put the mental health professional in it unless the mental health professional then offers to run the course and will come for a training and do it for free. I mean, we've had psychiatrists at McLean Hospital come, get trained, goes out in the community and runs the course for free. He probably gets $300 an hour, but not with us. He does it all for free. So the point is, if you are interested in becoming a leader, we would first have you go through the course, which would be by telephone, and then we'd have to be creative because we always do our trainings on a weekend. We'd have to think of how we could work it with Shabbos and maybe do like what Nefesh does. Do it in a place that would accommodate, the Sabbath. So anyhow, I'm getting ahead of myself. But just think about why we work with families. It's absolutely a natural step. If we're saying this is an environmentally induced disorder that gets stressed by the environment, it's a disorder of relationships, that working with families is a natural step. But families need special skills, okay? And if we think about, remember this, what was bad, hard for professionals? This is what families are dealing with, okay? We did a study to see what it's like to have a relative with this disorder, and the same study was done out in the community with people who had a relative primarily with schizophrenia. And gosh, we think of schizophrenia as the prototype of mental illness. So we wanted to see how the families compared. And this is what we found, that the level of stigma, family stigma, was higher in BPD than in schizophrenia. The level of burden, higher than in schizophrenia, right? Any of you who are family members probably would say, we could have told you that, you didn't need to do a study. The level of grief is the same as schizophrenia, not lower, but the same. The level of depression is the same, not lower. So what we then know is we need to do something for families. We need to get them involved. And referring back to that expressed emotion where I told you the critical comments, the hostility and the emotional over-involvement were not good for patients with schizophrenia, eating disorders, substance abuse, major depression, any other diagnostic category except for borderline personality disorder. And in fact, what it showed was that the more emotionally involved, over-involved, it said, a family member is, the better the patient fares. Now, I don't know about you, but I and Jill Hooley, who is my co-author on all of this, co-researcher, we decided to take out the word over in emotional involvement because, gosh, when you have a relative with an illness, whether it be a psychiatric or an emotional, I don't know what it means to be emotionally over-involved. You are involved, and that involvement is better for the patient because in probably on some level it makes the patient feel validated and heard, and they don't need to demonstrate their pain in other ways because somebody understands it. John Gunderson also did a study where the quality of family relationships was predictive. Yeah. Criticism doesn't impact for some reason. Yeah. Because I think it's a different kind of invalidation than the critical. Dismissing somebody's thoughts or feelings, oh, that, you know, you're not thirsty, or child falls down, there's nothing there. It's a different kind of invalidation. The critical comments don't seem to matter. So when an environment is invalidating, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's critical. It means that it doesn't support the internal world of the child. So that their thoughts, their feelings just are not validated. You know, it's like saying, I have a headache. No, you don't. That's not being critical. It's just disagreeing with what you're expressing. Well, it's more rejecting. It's rejecting. Yeah. Right. It's a denial of their reality. Right. Gosh, I'll have to think back into the study. It could be anything. You never clean your room. You're always spending too much. That's criticism. Over-involvement. Now, one example that stands out for me that's an example of over-involvement was a mother saying, when you're in the hospital, it's like I'm in the hospital. I suffer along with you. So can you see the sort of the depth of that, of really getting what the person's pain is like? That's the over-involvement where the patient feels heard. Does that make sense? It's helpful. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And you're absolutely right, and it is the worst thing. But what research is showing that these families suffer even more, which is hard. You know what? You can't even measure it. It's each person's life experience. You know. So no, and I don't mean to say that those are not incredibly painful. Yeah, that's what I'm going to do this afternoon, is talk about the skills. What we're talking about is one of the subset of skills are validation. How do you validate somebody? But they didn't know they were invalidating them. Someone's saying, but that's the same family. You're absolutely right, but that family didn't know that they were being invalidating. I never even heard of the word validation when I was raising my kids. What? Because you're saying the families were so invalidating, but the families want to do it differently now. Well, some families won't, and other families. We had one family went through the course 3 times. Families want to be helpful. They don't want to perpetuate this. They want their lives, their loved ones' lives, to be different. So you know, selling something that's going to make a difference. You talking about who? Oh, my patients, they always will say, absolutely, where do they go? Sign them up. Because if my family can work differently with me, why wouldn't I want that? But we also say it's for the family member. It's not for the ill relative. It's for the family member's well-being. If you go through that list of things, what they go through. Well, it depends on how toxic it is. I wouldn't want to make a general statement, but then sometimes you bring, if it's a husband and wife, you bring them both in and sort of work on how to change the dance together. Okay, so Yeah, the mother was saying that she's suffering. She's letting the adult child know that when her child's in the hospital, she feels as badly as the child. And, for some patients, they might say, who cares? It might not mean something, but it shows the depth of an understanding. Well, I think that if it's intrusive, then the patient's not going to want to do it. I mean, each one is different. You've got to get to know what's going on in that dyad to decide if it's too much or not. Yeah.